Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is Tuesday, July 16th, 2002. Today's session is titled Plant Life of the North Cascades, Symbiosis and Change. Session 2, Vegetation Zones of the North Cascades. It is presented by Joe Arnett. The number is ARJ2002-08. Let's listen in.
And if anybody's comes in late, we'll just, I'll interrupt a little bit from these handouts. So you can start the, wherever you are, you can start the tape now. They record, as you know, all the sessions in Holden, so that's our cue to tell them. So anything you don't want on the record, don't say it now. I know most of you, but I'm Joe Arnett, and I'm serving the village this week and last week as a botanist. So my job is to help people learn about plants however they want to. And what I've done, sort of as a course outline, is taken this outline of classification of things that are plants or plant-like organisms, and in some ways used it as a kind of a rough outline of the course. This is just to show you that when in modern classification, when we talk about plants, we exclude a lot of things that traditionally were considered plants or treated in the science of botany. For example, fungi have, in modern classification, been separated out, so they're a totally different kind of organism. And this protista is kind of a garbage can term for lots of different kinds of organisms that don't neatly fit into either plants or fungi. A lot of them are both photosynthetic, like plants are, and motile. They swim around. So in some ways they act like an animal and they also act like a plant. And this also includes algae, and even the large seaweeds are included in that kingdom. So just to orient you that what I'm able to talk about are just this kingdom, which is the kingdom of plants. And then within that kingdom there are two main groups, and one is the what we call vascular plants, which are just larger plants that have specialized tissue for transport of water and nutrient. And that includes ferns and horsetails and these two big groups, the conifers and flowering plants. And plants also includes what are called bryophytes, which include liverworts and hornworts, which are quite rare, and mosses. So these are very tiny plants, and I don't really know much about them. All right, sort of as an introduction. The first session yesterday, we talked about conifers because they're the dominant plant form around here. We live in Holden Village, we live in a very well-developed conifer forest. And so we use that as a starting point. And if you miss that one, I do have a list here of all the conifers in Holden. And those are sort of the characters in this story that we're going to tell today, which is talking about vegetation, which is how these different species of conifer and flowering plants sort them out by elevation and by where they're located east and west in the mountains. That's kind of a course outline in a way, a classification outline. Hopefully this doesn't bring back unhappy memories of biology. So what I want to do today is I want to go on a tour over the North Cascades, and point out the vegetation. The vegetation is basically how different species align themselves with each other in response to some environmental conditions, moisture or temperature, which are usually correlated very strongly with elevation. So this diagram is meant to represent a cross-section of the North Cascades, where this is the west side, this is Puget Trough over here, Puget Sound, Seattle area, where I live. And this is a transect right through the mountains here, coming down over to the east side of the mountains where you have very extensive sagebrush. So how many of you are from Washington, or live at least? Oh, everybody's from Washington.
Not me.
Except you. You're from?
Arizona.
Arizona, which is very different than this, so.
Yes.
The Well, the people that are here from the Midwest, I can usually correlate the vegetation here a little bit more with Minnesota, partly because I've studied, I've had projects in Minnesota, so I know some of what's going on there. But even in Arizona, you'd have a similar zonation in response to moisture. And as you went up into the mountains, you'd even have some of these zones, the Douglas fir and ponderosa pine zones. I don't know the area there well enough to know what you hit when you get to the top. In most cases, the species are different, but I do know they do have these two. So this is the North Cascades. And in introducing this whole topic or looking at any biological topic, I always like to remind myself and remind people that it's an infinite subject. When you look at all the great diversity of plant life and also the complexity of vegetation, how things arrange themselves on the landscape, it is infinite in human terms, and we just take whatever little piece we can look at in the time we have. So what I would like to look at for this session, sort of my goals for this session, is to show you in a general way what these major zones are, primarily the two forest zones, which is a temperate forest and an upper montane or boreal forest, and show you where Holden sits kind of at the boundary between these two. And then to show you that above and below the forest there are places where the forest ends because of some environmental limitation. And I'll talk about what those limitations are.
Is it possible that these elevations could be... Thanks very much. That these elevations could change based on the severity of weather in a particular state. Like, it seems like California, at least where I hike, it's like, I don't know, I think like Jeffrey Pines to being like sort of like ponderosa pines in sort of a way.
Oh yeah, they're very close relatives.
And they're like, 8,000 feet.
Right. These elevations that are given are right here at this latitude.
Okay.
This going across the middle of the North Cascades in Washington. As you go north, these elevations come down.
Okay. And as you go south,
and as you go south, they go up. Also, as you go to the interior of the continent, they also go up.
Oh.
So if you're in Colorado, a tree line might be at 9,000 feet, where here it's pretty low actually. If you go up into Alaska, even though I was just in Southeast Alaska the week before last, the tree line, this tree line is probably around 3,000 feet. And if you go further north, eventually it comes down to sea level. If you go up in the Arctic,
there's
tree line is sea level. There is no forest. So it really is dependent on, absolutely, on latitude and how far you are from the effects of the ocean. So if we start at the bottom and think of this lower tree line, what the limiting environmental factor for trees, the reason there aren't any trees below this point, is that it's too dry. That's simply what the limiting factor is. And over on the west side, this area of grassland, which is what it essentially is, below the tree line is extremely limited. It's just little local areas that are south-facing and dry, desiccated by wind, and have thin soil, and so trees just aren't able to survive there because of dryness. And it's developed, but it's very limited. A few acres here and there. If you've seen those bluffs along Puget Trough, like Whidbey Island and Eby's Landing, there's some patches there. Grasslands growing along the saltwater.
But on the west side of the forest goes all the way down to the water.
So it generally does, but there are local areas where it doesn't.
Yeah. Like Eby's Landing, that's a natural.
Like Eby's Landing or Yellow Island or.
Yeah.
There are just a few acres in extent.
Okay, where it's really dry, yes.
Where it's really dry. Now there's a compounding effect in here of fire that. Intentional or accidental burning that happened historically in these areas tended to expand the grasslands. So it's not just the dryness that's caused without human effect, but it's also the effect of fire caused by humans. And then on the east side of the mountains, below this tree line, we have a very extensive, tens of thousands of square miles of grassland, or areas dominated by grasses or shrubs. Grasses are the dominant growth form, shrubs are like the secondary. And then, and no trees, except in very local areas where there's more moisture, like long streams, where you might have enough moisture for trees. So when you think of Washington, you think, well, you don't live here. But other people think of Washington, they think of this, you know, well-developed coniferous forest. But we really have more surface area in grassland than we do in forests.
Hey, Joel?
Yeah.
Have you been to that section of sagebrush steppe over that was newly purchased by the Nature Conservancy?
Which one?
By Moses Lake.
Moses Cooley?
Moses
Lake up further?
Yeah.
I don't know if I've been to that.
Not Moses Lake, but it's just out, it's about maybe half an hour from the mansion.
I haven't been to it. It's Jameson Lake.
It's not a lake, it's in the hills.
Oh, Beasley Hills?
Beasley Hills.
Yeah, I don't know that I've been to that site. I've driven by it.
It's really nice.
Yeah, they've purchased actually lots of land through the sagebrush steppe. That's a big recent one, but I have been to one on Barker Mountain, which is up in Okanagan County, which is a preserve they bought. So then you come into the forest, and basically there's two broad subdivisions of the forest. And this one, the temperate forest, is aligned with the southern areas south of here, and includes species, or the species that dominate, or species that have adapted to more moderate, hot, dry conditions, and, well, hot, dry on this side, and moderate conditions on the west side. And when you get above this line, get into a forest which is more aligned with the northern habitats, like the boreal forest. All across North America, there's some variety or other of this spruce fir forest, which is called the boreal forest. Boreal just means northern, and it's the zonation is either because of elevation in the mountains, where we could call it a mountain, upper montane forest, or it's because of northern latitudes, in which case it would be a northern or boreal forest. But it's essentially the same. It's composed mostly of some species of fir and some species of spruce. Like in northern Minnesota, the fir is balsam fir, spruce, or black spruce and white spruce. Right here, the firs are subalpine fir or silver fir and Engelmann spruce. But sort of the general characteristics of the forest are very similar. Now, I might throw these species names out that you might not be familiar with, but I'll just use the names and you can look at the list there if you want to try to get familiar with them. Then as you go up in elevation, well, first let me say the boundary here is somewhere around 25 to 3,500 feet. If you start hiking up in the mountains, you'll notice if you come from Lake Chelan on this side, this lower portion is mostly ponderosa, or mostly Douglas fir, with just a scattering of ponderosa. And as you come up in elevation, you'll start to notice a few subalpine firs. When you get to Holden Village, which is right around in this elevation, probably Douglas fir is the most common species on the dry hillsides, and probably subalpine fir is the most common species in the lower, at the river bottom, where there's also a lot of spruce. So we are really right at the boundary. And as you go up in the forest, up in elevation, you gradually, the ponderosa drops out and the Douglas fir drops out. Though these aren't distinct lines on the landscape, there's a lot of overlap. You find a few ponderosa that get up much higher, just like you find a few subalpine firs that get a lot lower. Okay? And then, if you go up further, somewhere around 55 to 6,500 feet, you start coming into meadows, which are where the closed forest ends. And we start to have a patchwork of forest and meadow And that's what we call subalpine, this patchwork of meadow and forest. And the reason that this forest line occurs is because of a heavy snowpack in the subalpine. And I'll show you some pictures in a minute, but areas where the meadows are tend to be in basins where the snow accumulates and trees aren't able to be established, which is kind of the opposite of what happens down here, where trees tend to occur in depressions where there's more moisture. And then, if you continue far enough up in elevation, you get to a tree line. By definition, the tree line is the upper limit of upright tree growth. And the limiting factor here is lack of heat in the summertime. The cold in the winter doesn't seem to be a big problem. We have fairly mild winters here, where even way up in the mountains, the severity of the winter is nothing like the winter in the continental parts of North America. But the summertime, there's just not enough heat above this point to support tree growth. And so we get a very different kind of vegetation composed of very small, reduced plants. So that's a general picture of the zonation, the way the plants align themselves on the mountains. Just remember, this tree line here is formed because of moisture. It's too dry below it. And the forest line, which defines a subalpine, is formed by snowpack, heavy snowpack. And the tree line, which is the upper limit of tree growth, is because of lack of heat. So those kind of three main limiting conditions.
The ponderosa pine is a pretty low elevation tree.
Yeah.
It's like 2,000 to 2,500 feet, according to the charts.
Yeah, and I don't know what the lowest elevation, it probably goes down lower than that. These are generalities, and there's always local exceptions to all of these, sort of to this description, but this is a general picture of what the vegetation does. There's a lot of change going on, and there's one of the agents of change is that these zones tend to shift up and down in elevation in response to climatic change. So when we get a cool period, a long-term cool period, not just a couple of years, but a cool period in the climate, then these zones tend to come down in elevation. And then if you have a hot, dry period, these zones tend to move up. And so if you think of the ice ages, you know, something like 12,000 years ago, these zones came way down and the climate was really cool. And about 6,000 years ago, sort of halfway back to those ice ages, there was a period called the hypsothermal interval, which was really hot and dry. And so these zones moved up. So that's just one way that things change. The other complication is that there's a lot of fire and other disturbance that happens in here. And so those also tend to cause shifts both in where the zones might be, but even more shifts in what species might be at a particular place. You know, like Holden Village has pretty much of a mixed forest of subalpine fir and Douglas fir, the main two species. But if the forest around here was to burn with high intensity, you might have a different kind of forest start to establish itself.
So then one of the ways to track how much global warming is occurring would be to track vegetation.
Yeah. Yeah, it would be a good
aerial mapping of vegetation.
Yeah.
Because it would be something that would change over a relatively short period of time compared to.
I've actually never heard of that being done, but I've often thought, especially up in the Alpine, have a pretty distinct line. These tend to be much more affected by local disturbance like fire and also successional changes where the forest just gets older It changes because it's getting older. But this line is pretty much locked into temperature. And so it does seem that that would be a way of measuring. I've never seen that done, at least in the mountains. It may be done elsewhere. Does anybody know that kind of idea about?
So if there were a fire at this elevation and it burned every single tree, would you expect in 10 years to see mostly like lodgepole pine? Or
that's just, right. Yeah, that's what I'd expect to see. Lodgepole pine is the most common.
So does the temperature have to reach like a certain level before lodgepole pine seeds even?
Well, I've heard
something like that, but I don't know.
Yeah, in Minnesota we worked with this fire ecologist. And this is Minnesota forest, so it's a little different, but he said that the jack pine seeds would germinate at, and he had a precise temperature, like 114 degrees, or maybe it was 214, but I always thought that was a little bit more precise than the way nature operates. I think that you'd have, at lower temperatures, you'd have a certain number, and then it'd get to a certain temperature, you'd have the peak number of germinations, and then as it got hotter, eventually you'd be so hot you'd kill the seed. So does that make sense to you as kind of a picture of vegetation here? It's the kind of thing that's very interesting to vegetation scientists or botanists, but maybe not to everybody. But what I'd like to do next is show you some pictures. Kind of take a move from this lower grassland below the tree line, show you some examples of it, and then move up through the forest, and then look at some subalpine and alpine. You'll see the photos I have really tend to focus on this sagebrush steppe and the alpine subalpine, just because these places really have an intense flowering that happens all at once. You don't have very short seasons. And so they're more spectacular. And the forest tends to be more of it's mostly conifers, which don't catch our eye the same way.
I think we saw some aspen yesterday.
Yeah.
Yeah, and
would
that be subalpine?
Well, aspen actually goes all the way. It grows all the way down at the edge of sagebrush, and it grows all the way up into the subalpine fir zone. Probably right around 4,000 feet, something.
Yeah,
like
it's
that.
Pretty high.
Like on the way to Heart Lake, there's several patches of aspen.
They're pretty contrast with all the dark bark and firs.
Right. Yeah, and the aspen seems to come in where there's a little bit more moisture, both down here and up in the forest, in the mountains also.
Would wind have an effect on what grew? Maybe because wind?
Well, because it dries things out.
Dries things out, that's something.
It would have that effect,
yeah. So I remember a long time ago, I went to school at Ellensburg, so I took a Forest Service roads and I just headed west. Basically, it was pretty much in a straight line, and I got to sort of what was up. It seemed like a point of demarcation between what would be considered eastern Washington and what would be considered western Washington. And I think plant identification at that place would have been very difficult because there was no tree that was growing in a straight line.
Oh, is that right?
They were all bent or twisted, the branches were this way or something like that. Because I think the wind there was pretty steadily almost, going almost all the time.
Yeah, if you get high enough, you get into Krumholz. Krumholz means crooked wood. And that's where you get dwarf or stunted growth form of trees.
Okay.
And there seems to be both a genetic aspect of Krumholz, like they're genetically different than the forest trees, and also a response to.
As I said, I didn't know if they were different trees or not, but they were all pretty well short. There was no real tall trees, and they were all.
Yeah.
Just spelled with a K.
Yeah. I don't have a board. The screen of bread, but it's Krumholz, K-R-U-M-H-O-L-T-Z, Krumholz. There might be two M's, I'm not sure.
Probably named after Mr. Krumholz.
No, it means crooked wood. there could be a fictional character, Mr. Krumholz.
It's a name, yeah.
Yeah, kind of like Rumpelstiltskin. And I know that subalpine fir forms Krumholz. I don't think I've ever seen larch forming that. Whitebark pine wood, but subalpine fir and also Engelmann spruce will also form a crumholz. quite a bit. Okay. Well, let's look at a picture or two. And if we want to, I'm going to try turning this on and off. We might just leave it off, but if we need to come back to that diagram, we can also do so. Do you recognize where this is?
Lakeshore.
It's along the Lakeshore Trail in Malaysia Land.
Okay.
And this is, actually, I think this is Hunt's Bluff, which is just a little ways north of Lucerne. If you look north from Lucerne, there's a big cliff that comes down to the water. I think that's what this is. But this is just showing that there's a very small area along the lake, which is this grassland, which is here because it's too dry for tree growth. And the trees that are here are the most drought tolerant. This is ponderosa pine, which is the most drought tolerant tree we have at this latitude.
Yeah.
And Douglas fir, most of these are Douglas fir, which is also quite drought tolerant. If you go south, then you get into juniper areas where there's a lot of juniper, but really, there are a few individuals up here on Lake Chelan, but in general, there's no vegetation that's very well developed that has juniper. And mostly Washington just has occasional junipers, but not a vegetation. Hi, Leanne. This is a little better picture of that along Lake Chelan, a little more visible grassland and shrubs. This is bitterbrush. And this little patch, even though it's just a few acres, is a grassland, is sagebrush steppe, or you'd have to say shrub steppe because it's not sagebrush. So it very much has the same species as a sagebrush steppe out in eastern Washington.
So that could definitely not be caused, I'm just asking you, not just by elevation, just because it happens to be in a rocky area with very thin soil.
Thin soil, yeah, it's local. It's a local, because the trees do grow to the water. But these are south facing, exposed to the wind, exposed to the sun. And here again, fire is a player that affects where these lines are too. And this is just, it's too dark of a photo, but I left it in to show you that even on salt water, this is out in Puget Sound area, that there are grasslands. This is on Yellow Island, which is a nature conservancy preserve out on in a group of islands called the Wasp Islands. But they're very localized grasslands, but they're for the same reasons, too dry for trees. And this is down above the Columbia Gorge. This is a little higher elevation. This is like a couple thousand feet, but this is a steep south-facing slope, and there are grassy balds here that are caused because it's too dry for trees. This is right over the ridge. When you get to the north aspect, then there is enough moisture for trees, and you get a closed, continuous forest. So this is still the lower tree line caused by dryness.
It's because when it hits the slope, it drains off so fast.
It both drains off, and it's thin, and this is all growing on basalt, so it's, I don't know if that affects its drainage, but it's on Table Mountain. It's above Bonneville Dam. But in eastern Washington, that's where,
watch out for the wire.
You have, that's where we have these tens of thousands of square miles of sagebrush steppe.
Looks like the Sun Lakes.
Yeah, this is in Grand Coulee. Just, Sun Lakes, exactly. This dry, just below Dry Falls. This is another picture just to show that at first glance, it looks pretty bleak. You know, there isn't a lot of flowering most of the year, although this is spring. It's really green. That's why I took that picture. It's like this olive green sagebrush and grassland. But to get closer, to see the flowering, you have to get closer. This is also in Grand Coulee. And very brilliant flowering, just about the last of April, first of May. There's a very low rainfall, I don't know, something on the order of, well, Eastern Washington might go anywhere from 8 to 15 inches, maybe more in some areas. But dry enough so that most flowering happens in that pulse of moisture in the spring. And this is a species of lupin, and this is balsam root. Which, I don't think this lupin grows on Lake Chelan, but this balsam root does, here and there. So it's the same vegetation. And this blue-green is all sagebrush. Kind of another picture of the same thing, same kind of vegetation. You know, in 2 weeks, there probably won't be anything visible flowering in the wood. And this is just to show you, notice this person's hairdo. And notice that it's pushed forward. It's not actually the way it's intended, but just to show this really windy place. And the wind is kind of a feedback loop, because the wind exaggerates the dryness and helps keep the trees out. And because there's no trees, there's nothing to break the wind. And so the wind is a contributor to the dryness of the place. This is just outside of Ellensburg, above a place called Risa Creek. And we have lots of flowering plants that are quite beautiful. This is a little hedgehog cactus up on Whiskey Dick Mountain, which is above Ginkgo State Park. This is another example of that, of the flowering in the spring. This is a big-headed clover. And this is a type of desert parsley. There's dozens of species of desert parsley in Washington, and they were, some species were important food crops or food plants for native people, first peoples. It's also called biscuit root.
Is that big-headed clover, is that actually?
Not here, it's out in the sagebrush.
So something similar to that. It looked kind of like the Indian paintbrush
you saw. Up here in the ballpark?
Up by her. Yeah, it starts up there.
Yeah, there is a clover. This one is actually about 2 inches across. It's okay. It's big-headed clover. That's because it has big heads. And the one that grows, there's two species of clover growing along the trail there. One is Dutch clover, which is a little, it'd be about the size of maybe half of one of these. The cluster of flowers.
There's one that's red, reddish, pinkish.
So there's one red that's red clover, and it's a small version of this. I mean, different species, but it looks a lot like it. This is actually, I didn't notice this before, but this is a seed pod for a lily right here called yellow bells. There's another one. And then back to Lake Chelan, any place that you have a little more moisture, like this is a creek called Rattlesnake Creek, which is right across from, it's just north of Prince Creek, so it's a little ways down lake from where Lucerne is. But down at the bottom of this creek, there's a forest of maple. It's a big leaf maple right here. Just enough moisture so the trees can get going in there. We're up on the sides where it's too dry. It's grassland. But up in the forest, there's just a few pictures of this forest. This is the temperate forest. Remember those two big subdivisions, temperate forest would be Douglas fir, which is what this is. And that's what this is. Actually, this might be ponderosa. Those would be the, this looks like ponderosa too. Those would be the two main components of that temperate forest, ponderosa and Douglas fir. This could easily be outside of Holden. And then places where there's more moisture, we get western red cedar. That's what this is, with this fibrous bark. There's another red cedar here. That's our longest lived tree in the Northwest. They get 1,000 years plus. I don't know what the oldest one is. And then Douglas fir, this is a Douglas fir right here, with that very deep furrowed bark. So there's some old trees there. And this is just another example of that of a Douglas fir forest, a much, much drier site. Salal, understory salal, which is a tough, tough kind of leathery shrub. And you mentioned aspen, seeing aspen. Well, this is along Lake Chelan, in an area which is mostly grassland, or patches of ponderosa pine and Douglas fir. But there's a seepage that comes out of the hillside, and there's more moisture. And so there's a good stand of quaking aspen, just like you have up the valley here.
Is there maple in the background, or what is that?
It could be, because there is a lot of vine, of not vine maple, but big leaf maple that grows along there. Then this is showing the upper forest. It's either upper montane or boreal forest. And this is a subalpine fir forest, which is just like you might find above Holden on a cooler site. This is a mountain hemlock forest, which is getting up near the tree line. This photo is actually taken in Alaska, but just to show you that as you approach tree line, that mountain hemlock sometimes forms these closed forests like this.
What do you mean by closed forest?
That's where you don't have meadows. Pardon?
So near the old species of tree? Or?
No, closed just means that the canopy is almost 100%. So if you get a little higher, you start having more snow, then you have patches of meadow. But a closed forest would be where it's continuous canopy. Well, botanists always get upstaged by wildlife, you know, mm-hmm. if anything moves. And this is a gray jay or camper on it. And it's up in the subalpine. So we're getting up out to where the forest, this would be closed forest at the edge of it. Then we get into where there's patches of meadow. And notice that this is sort of a depression, like a valley bottom, where the snowpack would be hanging there. This is overexposed, but this is Miner's Ridge, which is if we were to walk about 20 miles that way, up the valley, and over Suiattle Pass, this is Plummer Mountain right here. Cloudy Pass is probably right about in here. So. But this is one of the biggest areas of subalpine that I can think of. And you can see that there's still trees growing here and there, even up on the ridge. So it's not too cold, but this is an area of accumulation of snowpack, and there's just not time for the trees to get established. I'm going to try to talk a little bit more on the day after tomorrow. I guess it's the day after tomorrow. It's Tuesday, Wednesday. Yeah, Thursday. About changes because of climatic change. But right now, you know, the trees are only able to hang on these promontories where the snow melts out a little earlier. Like down in here, the trees are really growing on the ridges, not in the basins.
Well, because there's less snow movement there?
The snow tend to blow off the ridges quicker and melt out. And then you've probably seen this, if you have a tree that finally is able to get established, it'll become a heat sink, or it'll absorb sunlight so that it becomes an area where the snow melts. A lot of times, as the snow melts out, you'll see a big kind of well around the trees because the darker color absorbs heat. This is another subalpine area. This is Juanita, Lake Juanita, over on the other side of the lake. But open meadows, patches of meadows with trees growing on the knolls. The tree-line species on our side of the mountains, the east side where we are, tend to be this, which is subalpine larch. And I don't see white-bark pine in this picture. But it's also a tree-line species, and this is subalpine fir. Over on the other side, the tree-line species tends most often to be mountain hemlock. This is a Image Lake, which is at the end of Miner's Ridge. And this is Glacier Peak over here. But real classic subalpine, beautiful parkland. People are really attracted to subalpine areas because of the open meadows and trees growing on the ridges where they're able to get established. And this is a white bark pine, which is, on the driest sites, it's the tree line species.
Well, living one.
This isn't a living one, no. This is an old one, but a big one, right up on the top of a ridge across the lake. Should measure that one. They don't usually get that big. So now we go up far enough, and eventually we come to a place where it's just too cold in the summertime for trees to get established. And this is what we call the alpine. And there's still a couple of stunted trees here. This is on the top of South Navar Peak, across on the east side of the lake. And you can look out, because it's the eastern edge of the Cascades, you can see this is the Waterville Plateau right here, which is a big wheat-growing country. But toward the end, I'll show you a picture that's taken right out in here somewhere. But up here, the vegetation tends to be these little cushion plants. This is a type of Antenaria, or it's called pussycoats, little cushion plants that grow very close to the ground where vegetation can get a little bit more heat and survive. Things get really reduced. This is a type of willow that's only about 2 inches tall. There's actually quite a number of species of willow that are grow in the alpine that are very reduced. This is the cluster flowers. This is a moss campion, which is sort of the quintessential cushion plant that grows in the alpine. And it grows in the alpine in the mountains, and it also grows in the Arctic tundra. So there's a lot of affinity between the tops of the high mountains and the vegetation that approaches the Arctic, or goes into the Arctic. It's about an inch tall. There's another one. This is a type of lupin. The moss campion is an Arctic tundra species that's moved down into the mountains. This lupin is a sagebrush or desert species which has moved up into the mountains, adapted by stages to survive in those environments. There's a lot of desert and sagebrush species up in the alpine because it's one of the limiting environmental factors is the dryness. So they have that pre-adapted dryness. This is another one. This is called Smilowskia. And that's both, this is a white one, common name and scientific name. But it's the flowering plant that grows at highest elevation in Washington.
What do you think?
No.
Okay.
No, Smilowskia I think he's a Russian botanist. That this was named after. Yeah. So I don't think it refers to its odor. I was going to say, it's in the mustard family. It's probably even edible if you really were starving and wanted to eat it. Those things are. This is called, most mustards are edible. This is called Douglasia, or snow Douglasia. So I've always really been attracted to the alpine area. A lot of beautiful plants there. And this is just to show you an example of alpine. This is the most extensive alpine area that I know of in Washington. This is on Burroughs Mountain on the way to Mount Rainier. And, you know, this whole area is above trees. And it's also quite accessible. You can go to Sunrise, which is a visitor center in the Mount Rainier National Park. You can drive up there. And this is like 2 or 3 miles out from the visitor center. And this is closer to home. This is on North Star Peak, which is right at the head of the valley here. Looking across, this is Mount Plummer. And this is Glacier Peak. And Miner's Ridge is kind of on the other side, that big subalpine meadow, kind of on the other side of this mountain. You can see that the north sides of these mountains tend to be much steeper, more glaciated, because snow would accumulate on the north side and form glaciers. South sides tend to be more gradual and gradually sloping like that, Miner's Ridge. This is the last one I'll leave you with. This is on Cloudy Peak at the head of the valley here, looking towards Glacier Peak. And you can imagine these forests, the forest zones, down in the lower elevations, kind of, you can see, it's kind of down in the mist, but this is the upper limit of forest. And then these are subalpine meadows right in here. Areas of heavy snowpack, places where the snow keeps the trees out, but there's still trees down there, clumps of trees growing on ridges and promontories. And then you get up to the elevation where we're standing, and this is true alpine, where we just have very stunted cushion plants and no trees. So that's the last.
Where's Cloudy Pass?
Last quote. Oh, Cloudy Pass is right here.
So if you were to go to the left, then you go to Bolden Village?
Yeah, Bolden Village, you go down this way. Okay. Down Lyman Lake is down in the bowl here. Yeah. You go down the valley to Bolden. And if you go on the other side, this is Suyattle Pass is right here. And the Suyattle River is right down in that valley.
Are you a mountain climber too?
Well, I don't do climbing with ropes and equipment.
Would you like to go up the tops?
Oh, I do. I love to get to the tops, yeah. In fact, maybe my favorite mountain of all that I climbed was Plummer, which is right here. And I climbed it, you know, carrying a backpack and just with shoes, but it was steep enough and high enough so that you got up there, but not like you're...
feel like you have summititis, or you just like the top?
Oh, I don't think I have summititis.
I had some in college and had summititis, no matter where we were.
No matter what, yeah.
No matter what we had to do.
Right.
We needed to be on top of whatever it was.
Cows do that.
Cows do
that? Yeah, they have some feet, you know, if you have cow fields. All the cows are trying to get to the top of the ice.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah.
No, that's really interesting. I never realized.
Most of the cows count because they're dumb. But, you know, probably more other degrees other than the cattle, like you know, on there is competitive.
But dairy cows will have to talk to them.
You see them on a dairy farm, they'll all be clustered around this little knoll or something.
Huh. So it's probably protection, you know,
survival, yeah.
Where they can see what's coming. Which is, I think, why we like it, too.
So what's the area that goes in for the, I don't know what kind of boulders they would be, but the ones that curve down a slope like this, the Roman spears.
The alders?
The alders, yeah.
They're called slide alder.
Okay.
Or Sitka alder.
Okay.
It grows along, that's the alder growing along here.
Yeah. I don't think any of them more particular, like Martin Ridgewood.
Right.
I guess I should be looking, last year I came up there and sort of exploratory, I don't know, like, three or four exploratory hikes trying to find my, you know, just by myself, trying to find a way to mark. I should have been looking for areas of less moisture, I guess, because that would be better.
Well, maybe so.
Better in the grasslands.
You'd have less alder to
contend. Yeah, exactly. Because maybe one with the where our congregation members took off Martin Ridge. Actually, that was 2 years before that. Stripped off a bunch of white towels and so forth and marked them on these white alders. Always thinking we'd be able to find our way back, should we? We didn't see one of our white strips on the way back.
Oh, yeah, white flagging doesn't show up too well.
We did find out that going down through those, I suppose it's because of snow movement, that these things grow up and they just end up bending down slope because of all the snow movement.
Right.
But going down the slope by those things is much, much easier than going up the slope.
Yeah, I know.
They grow in all in this entire area, or how far up in the elevation would they typically be?
Guys, we'll have to do some research and find out just how high up would go. But I bet they go up 6,000 feet or something.
Okay, so they're pretty high.
Yeah. Well, we have to close. We have to get out of here so the next people can come in.
Thanks so much.
So thanks for coming. And. Next time, we're going to talk about flowering plants, diversity of flowers and flowering plants.
Is that tomorrow morning?
Yes, I think it's at 10:45 tomorrow morning. All right. Well, enjoy. over to dinner.
Thank you. Joe, you know that picture you said was overexposed?
Yeah.
It was beautiful.
Oh, Miner's Edge?
Yeah, it looks like a painting because of the, I don't know, because of the loss of the detail or something. It looks so smooth. It's like a watercolor.
Oh, yeah. Well, thanks. That's a nice consolation art. It's a beautiful place.
As a botany picture, maybe not, but as a image, it's gorgeous.
Okay, I'll keep it in there.
We didn't pick anybody's spot for the hike, did we?